In 1988, Father Michael completed his doctoral degree at the Orthodox Theological Faculty in Prešov, Slovakia, with an emphasis on Native Alaskan history. He is recognized as an elder by the Alaska Federation of Natives. He is a distinguished public servant recognized by the Board of Regents at the University of Alaska. Father Michael has been honored by the Alaska State Legislature as an educator. He fosters greater understanding across the boundaries of race and culture. Among his several books, one in particular stands out for me, and that is Another Culture, Another World. In that book, he asks, what is a culture? What's your culture? Do you have a culture? And he answers, everyone does. The best definition of culture, he says, is the way you see the world. But you can't see the way you see the world. Your own culture is always invisible to you. We can look at other people's cultures and how theirs differs from our own, but we can't put into words our own very well. Cultures, he says, are ways of seeing. At Furman University last night, Father Michael's presentation last night, one of the most, and this is, it borders on self-praise because I'm talking about my grandson here, one of the most talented and brilliant young men I know. It's true. I mean, he just happens to be my grandson. Matthew Deininger asked Father Michael a question last night that haunts me. Matthew asked Father Michael, why do you draw so much from cultures, from sources outside Orthodox Christianity? And his question led me to ask these three questions of Father Michael. First, isn't it true that our Orthodox Christian faith has saved the Alaskan way of seeing the world, has saved that culture from marginalization and self-isolation by bringing it into a new way of being Christian? Happened to the Greeks, happened to the Slavic peoples, has happened to every people that has become Orthodox, has happened to the Aleutian people, the Tlingit people, the native peoples of Alaska, has yet to happen to those of us who live in the lower 48. We're all anxious to see how that's going to turn out. And second, isn't it also true that the deep insights of that Native American Orthodox understanding of the world is now as Orthodox as Greek theology, Russian literature, Romanian monasticism, and any other culturally based way of seeing the world? And finally, isn't Native American Orthodox Christianity now a vital part of our own American way of seeing the world? I've always found Father Michael's work and his teaching inspiring. I use his lectures in my course on world religions and have done so for many years. So it gives me great pleasure to have him here to speak to us this evening. Father Michael.
Since we're being recorded, I think I have to stand more or less still. Respect our recording device here.
Well, here's a
I don't really need the lectern because
here's a backup.
Okay.
And we could put this on to you.
Even better, sure.
You can do whatever you want.
Okay, thank you. Father Jacob's absolutely right. I think that the answer to his questions is really relevant to us. The gospel parable that's probably the most missiological is the sower. It's the same seed, right? In two of the three gospels where the parable of the sower is recorded, the seed is scattered and it produces the same harvest, 100-fold. You know, some of the seed falls on the rock, doesn't do anything. Some falls upon weeds. Some gets eaten by the birds. And then finally there's some that actually grows. And I think it's in Matthew and Luke, and those that grows produces 100-fold. But in the Gospel of Mark, it's different. The seed produces a harvest of 30, 60, and 100-fold. Mark has a slightly different spin at the end of his gospel. And what does that mean? Well, I've taken that to mean and applying it to Alaska and looking around the world. The same gospel produces a different harvest, even though it's the same seed, because the earth and climatic conditions determine the outcome. It's not just the seed, because after all, some of the seed didn't grow at all. Some of it fell among the rocks, some of it fell in the weeds, some of it fell among the birds and got eaten. But even that which grows produces a different harvest. And that's what we can expect in any country and in any culture. The culture is the context into which the seed is planted. And some harvests are 30 and some 60 and some 100. And so you could say, over the last 2,000 years, the same gospel, the same faith, the same church has arrived and been planted in Greece, and you could say it produced a Greek harvest. And it fell in the Balkans, and it produced a Balkan harvest. And it fell in Russia, and it produced a Russian harvest. And now it's being planted in America, and as Father says, we're waiting to see what the American harvest will look like. But it's been in the soil of Alaska now for over two centuries. So we can begin to look at what that harvest is. But the missionaries, when they came to Alaska, and I think it was very wise of them, came to examine the climatic and soil conditions first. Now, why did they do that? They walked 8,000 miles across Siberia, and there were no Ramada or Holiday or whatever other inns you might have. They had no place to stay night by night by night as they walked across Russia and Siberia, except the nearest monastery. They were welcomed by any monastic community as brothers, because we don't have religious orders, as you know. A monk is a monk. A monastery is a monastery. They're all doing the same thing. They're having the same services. And so those monks crossing from Valam, from European Russia, crossing the Urals, coming across Siberia all the way to the Pacific Ocean, they were, without consciously noting it at the beginning, they were reviewing the missionary expansion of the Christian faith, of the Orthodox faith, across North Asia. Because each of those monasteries, in their turn, had been founded just beyond the present boundaries of the empire. You know, monks don't like downtown. They like wilderness. And so the wilderness is just beyond where the last city has been built. Usually it's the frontiersmen who go out there and trap and fish and, you know, the American West had the Daniel Boone, the Davy Crockett, the Jeremiah Johnson. Now there's that new film, The Revenant. If any of you have seen, that's the kind of people who usually venture into the wilderness first. They're like allergic to city life. They want to get away from all of that. And they move into the wilderness and they chop down trees and build themselves a cabin. Most of them are bachelors, actually. They're not even interested in matrimony and families. They just want to get out there and live off the land. Right behind them, in Russia, came the monks. They're the next ones. And after that comes, you know, the traders and the businessmen and people who build hotels and people who put up taverns. And a town starts. And then the frontiersmen have to move further. And right behind them, the monks move further. And so this kind of leapfrog movement. We had the Wild West in America. Russia has, even to this day, the Wild East. But with almost the same kind of personalities, except America didn't have any monastics. Russia did. So the Valam monks recruited to cross all of it, North Asia, were, without consciously recognizing or realizing they were doing it, they were reviewing the missionary expansion of Orthodoxy across the country. And those monasteries, as they grew and as people kind of settled in, they very often learned the local Siberian native language. In Kazan, the monastery became the University of Kazan and a center for the study of Siberian languages. Certainly the monks, as they crossed Asia, encountered this and realized. Now, it gave them, they weren't trained as theologians, they weren't trained as missionaries. Most of them weren't clergy. They had never even gone to seminary. Only one of the 10 had ever gone to seminary. But walking 8,000 miles across the entire Asian continent, they reviewed and must have gotten some idea, when we get to Kodiak, how do you proceed? Where do you start? And very wisely, therefore, they sat down for about 9 months with the local indigenous population, the Aleutics, and basically said, tell us your stories. What do you already believe about God? What do you already believe about spiritual life? Heaven? Hell? What happens to souls when they die? These kind of basic religious questions. And they got the answers. And then they, in May of 1795, they wrote their report back to Finland, back to Valam. We can work with this. These people believe in a supreme being, a creator of heaven and earth. They believe that all human beings are descended from the same ancient first parents. They don't call them Adam and Eve, but let's not quibble about that. At least they have the idea that all men and women are, in fact, brothers, sisters. They have a story of the flood. They pretty much have worked out the Ten Commandments, which, by the way, most tribal peoples have. If you're going to live together in a community, even a small one of a few hundred, you can't go around robbing from each other, stealing from each other, lying to each other. In a certain sense, most of the Ten Commandments are common sense sociological rules, right? And they basically said, we can work with these, but they were studying the soil conditions and the climate before they even started to plant the seed. And they presented the seed, the gospel, not as the replacement of what these people already knew, but as the fulfillment. I would say this is kind of a stroke of genius. We're not going to tell these people, oh, what you've learned before and what your grandparents and elders have told you is all wrong. There were missionaries who did this. It's all from the devil. You have to get rid of all of that, forget all of that, even your own language, and adopt our culture and our language in order to get admitted to heaven. You can't go to heaven as an Aleut, an Eskimo, or an Indian. You basically have to become, in the case of the United States, you basically have to become a Puritan and pretend you came off the Mayflower. And to the extent that you can pretend that you're one of us and have adopted our language and our culture, to that extent, we'll accept you and you're in. But our missionaries didn't take that position. You can keep your language. You can keep your culture. You can keep most of your traditions, because we can affirm most of that. And the few things that don't quite harmonize with the gospel, for now we'll let that go. What we want is you in the family. Once you're in the family, then we can discuss some of those other things that might be a bit questionable, like polygamy. This is a big question, by the way, even in the modern world, in Africa, where an African man, especially a prosperous one, is expected to have several wives. And if you don't, there's something wrong with you. And if you convert this man to Christianity, what's he supposed to do with wives 2, 3, and 4? Kick them out? And how are those children are supposed to survive? There are the practical aspects to this. The church isn't going to have multiple marriages, one man and several women. But they also can't just insist right off the bat that this man, living according to his own culture, is going to kick the women and children out. What, to starve? How Christian is that? You see what I'm saying? You have to kind of weigh these things and let the gospel seed grow and let the gospel, the teachings of Christ, gradually sort of percolate through that soil. And then, in a generation or two, we expect those practices or beliefs that are not in harmony with the gospel to gradually fade away. If they don't, we'll have to do something about that. But in the initial stages, Christianity comes to bless and to sanctify what's already there. It doesn't come to wipe the slate clean and bring something in from someplace else. But there have been missions that tried that. By the way, it never works. We're in many places evangelized by Western Protestants. This is exactly the trauma for now. They became Christian and they were told they had to pretty much renounce their own culture in order to get into heaven. And half the tribe did and half of them didn't. And then the next generation is saying, well, maybe grandma made a mistake. And there were Tlingit people in Southeast Alaska who were told by American Protestants that in order to be Christian at all, they had to renounce, never speak their language again, never participate in any of the public ceremonies of the tribe, and basically renounce your own identity. There were entire villages that did that because they thought that was the price of salvation. Within 3 generations, those same villages had the highest suicide rates in North America. And you see what I'm saying? You can't take all the soil out and then try to plant seed on what? On rock? We know what happens to the seed that falls on the rock. We know what happens to the seed that falls among the weeds. You've got to deal with what you've got. It's like every school teacher, they might want to have all A-plus students in their classroom, but they're very unlikely they will. There's going to be some kids who really don't want to be in school and aren't going to pay attention. There's going to be some children of minimal academic intelligence and gifts. They have other talents and gifts, but not necessarily reading, writing, and arithmetic. But they're still in your class. You've got to deal with the kids you've got. That happens in your own family. You've got to deal with the kids you've had. You don't get a choice. with all their gifts and all their talents, and then all the things that they're not so good at, you got to accept that. And the missionaries therefore came to Alaska and said, okay, what are the soil conditions? And then built on that. And that's why they spent months not preaching the gospel at all, but precisely figuring out, what do these people already know, and how can we present the gospel as its fulfillment? It's exactly why St. Innocent, as his first translation into Aleut, chose the Gospel of Matthew. You know, the Gospel of Matthew is not the first one that was written, Mark was. But the church put Matthew first. And if you think of it, that it's for the same reason. Matthew is the only evangelist who refers back to the Old Testament time and time and time again. He's the bridge between the New and Old Testaments because he's the one who constantly says, and this happened to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet, and then whatever it was, right? So Matthew is presenting the gospel as the fulfillment of the expectation of the spiritual culture that into which the gospel is being planted. And that's how our missionaries presented this faith. Now, I've used this word culture several times, and I think I want to spend maybe half an hour, I usually spend several days in my college class, discussing three definitions of what a culture is. And the one, first has already been mentioned. Your culture is the way you see the world. I stumbled into this teaching fourth grade biology. It wasn't my specialty, I was subbing. The teacher was sick or whatever, and they called me in. And much to my delight, the lesson that day, for which I had to open the textbook and find out where they were, the lesson for that day was on animals. And as, if you've heard any of my lectures so far, you know, animals is one thing, a topic, one thing Alaska Native people know a lot about. They think of the animals as sort of superior creatures who see and do things humans can't see or do. But more importantly, they hunt the animals, and hunting the animals is necessary for their survival. They know what the animals look like. They know where they live. They know where to find them. They know how to kill them. They know how to skin them. They know how to cook them, and they know what they taste like. If there's one thing they know a lot about, it's animals. Every animal in their ecosystem, they've seen, studied, and eaten. So they literally know the animals inside out. This should be the easiest biology class any 10th grader ever had. But I had to follow the book. So we go through the chapter, and then the next day, the book has a follow-up quiz. And I had to administer it, it was my job. But the answers I got on that quiz made no sense to me at all. It certainly didn't match the answer key that came with the book. And I wasn't the only one. The other teachers, most of them rookies at our village school, were having the same experience. Day after day, they dragged themselves into the faculty lounge, collapse on a chair or sofa, and exclaim, "These kids." That was the first semester. The second semester, they were collapsing, throwing up their arms and saying, "These people." By the second year, same gesture, "This place." Which meant they were leaving. To be replaced by another bunch of rookies from someplace else, some other state in the Union, who would go through exactly the same syndrome. These kids, these people, this place, and out of here. I've been in Alaska now 47 years. I wish I could report to you that the situation has changed. It has not. Every 2 to 3 years, we lose about half the teachers, and the next 2 or 3 years, we lose the other half. They never stick around, and they leave, as it were, shaking the proverbial dust from their sandals, blaming the community, those kids, these people, this place, and gone again. Now, my first decade, I didn't get it either. But after about 10 years in villages in Alaska, I realized there was nothing wrong with these kids, and there was nothing wrong with these people, and there was certainly nothing wrong with this magnificently beautiful place. What we had was a chronic case of communications breakdown. And here's the problem. The same word does not mean the same thing to people of two different cultures. And we've already talked about animals. If you come from a culture in which animals are viewed as inferior beings and being turned into an animal is a curse, which is the way I was brought up, Beauty and the Beast, the Frog Prince, werewolves, Think about that for a minute. Is it a promotion or a demotion to be turned into an animal in European folklore? It's pretty obviously a demotion, right? It's better to be human. Then you hear the stories that Alaskans tell their kids, and it's just the opposite. I'll tell you one. Once upon a time, a long time ago, there was a grandmother and her grandson, does sound familiar, living all alone, and they were out of food. That's as far as the two stories are, by the way, the same. But you think I'm telling the same story I told. This is the new story, honest. But there are hundreds of stories that start exactly the same way. Long time ago, grandmother, grandson, out of food. And the grandmother says to the boy, you've got to go hunting. It's your first solo trip. But a few pointers. You see that mountain over there? It's a very dangerous mountain. Don't go anywhere near that mountain. And you see that bay? Don't go into that bay either. And that forest. All the other forests are fine, cool. You can go any, but not that forest, not that bay, not that mountain. He's a teenage boy. You all know where he's going, don't you? And so does Grandma. One last thing as he's shoving off in his kayak. Take this with you. And she hands him a shriveled up piece of fur. And take this. Why are you giving me this old piece of fur? She says, it's not an ordinary piece of fur. This is a mink skin. All right, it's a mink skin. What am I supposed to do with it? She says, this mink skin is important. It could save your life. How's this piece of fur going to save my life? She says, you'll see. If you find yourself in any danger, in any predicament, you can use this piece of fur, this mink skin. How? She says, you chew on it, stretch it, and pull it over your head. Yeah, right. He stuffed the mink skin up his sleeve and paddled straight to the mountain, first of all, that he wasn't supposed to touch. He doesn't just touch it, he starts to climb it. Halfway up the mountain, there's a tremor, an earthquake. A landslide buries the boy alive, and he's been now, well, covered in debris. He's buried alive. He's going to run out of oxygen in just a few minutes. In a panic, he remembers that mink skin that he'd stuffed up his sleeve and pulls it out. He chews on it and stretches it, as Grandma told him to do. He pulls it over his head, and he's instantly turned into a mink. In the shape of a mink, he burrows his way out to the sunshine, to the surface. Fresh air, he's alive, he can breathe, he hurries back to his kayak, and he goes to the other places where he wasn't supposed to go. I'll skip that part, it'll take too long. But on the way home, having survived by turning himself into a mink and back into a boy, into a mink and back into a boy, on the way home he comes to a lake as big as this property, teeming with fat, plump, happy, contented mink. It looks like they're having so much fun. He pulls out the mink skin. He chews on it. He stretches it. He pulls it over his head. He turns himself into a mink and lives happily ever after. The first time I heard that story, I was a bit perplexed. It's exactly the opposite of any story I heard when I was growing up. I had to ask the elders, why do you tell this story to your children? They grew up hearing this kind of a story. And they said, so they will respect the animals. And their idea is, animals are not inferior forms of life in some ways. As I said earlier, they're superior. And we have to have respect for life wherever we encounter it. In plants, in animals, as well as in other human beings. The presence of life is something sacred that has to be treated with reverence. That's the basic notion. And so the mink boy story is told. And that's why the kids' answers on the biology quiz didn't make any sense. We were using the word animal, but whoever wrote the textbook, probably somebody in Texas, right, that's where we get our textbooks from, had the European idea of animal in mind, and the kids who are taking the test have the Aleut idea of animal in mind. The word animal is the only thing they share. What they mean by it is a different reality. And it's this kind of breakdown in communication where we think we're communicating, but we really aren't, that was frustrating the teachers, and not just the teachers, law enforcement officers, healthcare providers, almost anybody who had to deal with rural Alaska Native kids was having the same frustration and quitting and leaving to be replaced by even more people who also had no clue. That's when about 35 years ago I began teaching this class. I figured, we can do better. There's no reason for those committed, well-educated, professional people to come into our villages and condemn our people. Stupid, backward, ignorant, impolite, rude, incompetent. I mean, they have all these negative stereotypes of the children and adults in our village, and they leave bad-mouthing them. So the next group that comes in doesn't come in with a clean slate. They come in hearing all the negative attitudes and reports. The last group on the way out left behind. So our people are actually suffering from this. And it's a breakdown in communication. So I began teaching a class, actually not a class. I would welcome the new teachers to our village. They had unpacking to do the first couple of days they arrived. I'd go over and kind of introduce myself as the priest from down the road and tell them, you probably heard some negative things about this village and these people and these kids, but I hope I can, sort of break you in, orient you, give you a more positive view. I've been here for all these years, and they would listen politely. But they had no reason to adhere to anything I said. I was just the priest from down the road. And so I would see them making the same mistakes as the others, and within 3 years, gone again. And then they offered me to teach this class at the university. And finally, it became mandatory for all new teachers. They have to take my class. I think that's a good thing. And I get paid for it now. The free advice was not valued. When they call me in and to do an in-service and I get paid by the head, they know that I'm being paid to teach them. They have to take it seriously now, and they have to pass. So they, you see, I've sort of infiltrated their system. And in fact, next week I have a special class. So the last 3 days, not next week, the week after, they're flying me up to Anchorage. I have 20 people who need to take my class because, of course, they procrastinated. They had 3 years. They have their backs to the wall. And they're going to have to read another culture, another world. And I've, in a sense, there's, to tell you the truth, there's no money in the priesthood. I've survived in Alaska for over 30 years teaching this class, but I see it as part of my priestly ministry, because who suffers the most from this situation we have today? These kids, these people, this place. The ones who suffer the most from this revolving door are precisely these kids, these people, and this place. I wish we could stop that. I would be happy for the new professionals to come in and actually enjoy being in this village and appreciate the culture and get to know the people and maybe stay. I don't really care. I'd rather have a good teacher for 2 years than a bad one for 10. Just retaining them isn't necessarily my goal. But if they are going to be there for 2 years, I want them to enjoy it. I want them to like these people and these kids and this place and not dismiss them, condemn them, and walk away. I think that's part of the mission of the church. We're in favor of people getting along, as a minimum. We would like people to like each other and live harmoniously together. And that's not just in Alaska, that's everywhere. We'd like people to live in peace and harmony and mutual appreciation and respect. But the biggest hassle, the biggest problem as I see it, is the very problem that the same word does not mean the same thing. We could say this is the same thing between churches. The word church in the Orthodox tradition doesn't mean the same thing as the word church in the Catholic or Protestant traditions. Our experience of church and what we mean by church is really a different reality. When we say the Eucharist, when we talk about Holy Communion, our experience, it's the same word, but we know it's not the same reality. When we talk about sanctification or blessing, we have a tangible sense of what that means. Others, it's not so clear. You see what I'm saying? So this could also be applied to ecumenical relations. Just trying to get along with Christians of other traditions, we really need to examine it as a cross-cultural communications breakdown, because that's really what we're suffering from, only for the last 1,000 years. For the first 1,000 years, it wasn't so bad, but the second 1,000 years has gotten really nasty. So I say church, you say church. Are we talking about the same thing? Now, how do we explain this, first of all? It was mentioned, your culture is the way you see the world. Okay, what does that really mean? As a metaphor, I would present this to you. It's actually based on an essay from C.S. Lewis called Meditations in a Tool Shed. C.S. Lewis, like 50 years ago or more, was going out to his garden shed, and he says, I walked in, closed the door behind me, and at first, because it was so dark inside the shed, I couldn't see what I had come for. What I could see, he says, very clearly, was a shaft of sunlight that came through a gap in the shed roof. And that sunlight shone from through the hole in the roof down to the floor in front of me. And I stopped and looked at that beam of light. And I could see hundreds of little particles of dust suspended there in that brightness. Most of us have had an experience like this. I looked at the light. Then he says, I stepped into the shed and looked out along that beam of light. I could see the sun 93 million miles away. I could see the blue sky out there and white clouds. And closer down, closer to the shed, I could see the willow tree that overhangs that corner of the building and insects and birds flitting past. But while I'm in the beam of light, I can't see the beam of light. Once I've stepped into it and I start looking along it, the shed disappears and the beam of light disappears. While you're in it, you can't see it. That's your culture. Your culture is the beam of light along which you see the world. And what you see is accurate and good and true. That's not in dispute here. But someone from another culture, metaphorically speaking, is like someone who came in a different door and stands and looks along a different beam of light. There will be differences. There's a pine tree over in this corner. And the sky over here, because there's a storm coming, the sky here isn't blue, it's more gray than blue. And the clouds here are charcoal rather than white. So the person standing here will say to the other guy, I see the world. The thing you call the sun, I can't quite see it at all. The sky, what you call the sky, I say it's gray, not blue. And what you call the clouds, I say, are charcoal, not white. And the tree has needles, not leaves. Now, you want to fight about it? Is it a matter of right and wrong, better or worse, or is it just different? There's the rub. It's not a matter of better. My Aleut kids, I would say, were standing in their beam of light, seeing the world their way, and it makes perfect sense to them. And what they see is true. Accurate. But so is this other guy. And so we argue about it and fight about it when in fact they have something important to tell us. And we might have something important to tell them. Can we talk? It's Joan Rivers' line, right? Can we talk? Or are we going to fight? And we'd rather fight because we're so sure our way of seeing is right. And I would say, but that's not the point. Of course it's right, but the barn has 150 different slots. We move from shed to barn, you notice. But the building is so big, you can see the world this way, and you can see it this way, and you can see it this way, and on and on. And it's not a matter. Wouldn't we be wise if we could walk through the whole shed? Wouldn't be that. No, everybody would stay in their own beam of light and then insist that they're right. They are. That's not the point. There are other ways of seeing. And when it comes to human cultures, there's literally hundreds. But most people never leave home, you know? I think only like 25 or 30% of the American population has a passport. So all of us, 300 plus million, stand in our own beam of light, we see the world our way, and we insist that it's right, true, and good. Which it is. It's just not the only way. And we won't even hear when somebody contradicts us. Because we think that they're judging us and they're arguing that we are wrong. It's once we put it into the categories of right and wrong, we're done for. If we can just say, it's different. And this way of seeing could enrich us if we could hear those stories. And I would say that that's what happened to me. I studied theology in seminary. Nothing that I've learned in Alaska has contradicted what I learned in seminary, but it has much expanded and enriched my understanding of the same words. Those words mean more to me now than before, because it's not just one definition that I can accept, it's 10. Father Alexander Schmemann, for example, in the final paragraph or two of his most famous book, For the Life of the World, defines a Christian this way. A Christian is a person who, wherever he or she looks, sees Christ and rejoices in him. I love that definition. And I understood it, I thought, as a teenager when I first read those words. A Christian is the person who, wherever he or she looks, sees Christ. But when I was a teenager, I understood wherever he or she looks to mean in the faces of others. And I'm sure Father Alexander meant at least that. But I think he meant more that I didn't get reading it the first time. Then I go to Alaska, and what my Alaska native neighbors and friends are saying is, it's not just in the eyes of the human beings. It's not just in the face of other people that we see Christ and rejoice. It's in all of nature. It's in the rising of the sun and the setting. It's in the mountains. It's in the forests. It's in the animals. It's in the whole glorious, beautiful tapestry of nature. And the Holy Fathers, by the way, say the same thing. St. Maximus the Confessor says, the Word of God is constantly trying to be embodied. And there have been at least three embodiments. The first embodiment of the Word of God is precisely in the creation. And St. John of Damascus says that the universe, the creation, is God's self-portrait. Now that rings true with my Aleut and Eskimo neighbors. They understood that before the missionaries came. I come to learn it from them, but it doesn't contradict my Orthodox theology. It's just the theology I never quite got, even though I read it in seminary. Now I understand it in a deeper, richer way. I haven't been paganized by this. I'm appreciating some aspects of Orthodox theology that didn't mean anything when I was reading it in the suburbs of New York. Now when I read it on Kodiak Island, it's a different story. I get it now, because I've stepped out of my one beam of light into the next, and my Orthodox theology includes both. It wasn't an either-or choice. I don't have to decide which one's right and which one's wrong. They're different, and they're both mine. That's a wonderful thing. I feel blessed by that. So, the way you see the world, I think we've exhausted that theme. A culture is also, in a sense, the ball game of life as you understand and play it. This is a little bit more concrete. The ball game of life as you understand and play. It's sort of like this. When you and I and all hearing people were infants, in the first 2 years of life, we did something rather extraordinary. We learned an entire language with all its grammar, all its vocabulary, and all its syntax. When you try to learn a second language later, you realize how hard that is. But we did it as babies, probably because we had nothing else to do. I mean, you're laying flat on your back for months at a time, and they never give you a very interesting ceiling. So what are you doing? You think that kid's not doing anything. That child is absorbing every sound in their environment. And when they're a few months old, they begin trying to make those sounds, mostly gibberish. Blah, 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 blah. They're experimenting with what tongues and lips and teeth and larynxes can do. They have to do this on their own, right? We all did it as babies. And then, after the first year or so, we start making sounds that actually mean something. We don't realize that they mean something. Probably most kids do something quite by accident, like mama. And mother goes crazy. Right? And the baby gets kissed for this. Oh, mama, mama. And the baby does it again. Mama, more. There's some reinforcements here, right? Because mama are some of the simplest things for the lips and the voice to make. And when papa takes a little longer because it's just harder to make the sound rather than the ma. But you see, little by little, we all went through this process of learning a language which is not just sounds. It's grammatical structure and syntax. So by the time we're three, we've got it down. Two-year-olds are just frustrated non-speakers. They know what they want, they just can't articulate it. That's what gives you the terrible twos. But they already know. They already have a mind of their own, and they already know what they like and don't like, and they're spitting out the food they don't like. They let you know that and knock it off the high chair. We're way smart. Human beings are amazing creatures, but we're learning not just the grammatical rules of our language, we're learning what I will call the cultural ballgame rules of life. In other words, you're not only learning the right way to pronounce and say things, you're learning very gradually in the first 2-3 years of life what is acceptable behavior and what is not. And we don't remember doing any of this. You don't think about your grammatical rules when you speak your first language. You might have to think about it when you're learning your second or third, because it doesn't come quite as naturally. But the first language is just on your hard drive. And you don't even know that there are rules until you meet a foreigner who mispronounces a word. And then you say, that wasn't the right way to say that. Or you meet a foreigner who puts the words in the wrong sequence. Or they use a completely inappropriate word that sounds really funny. There's a Russian guy in Los Angeles, I heard, he was constantly putting the wrong ending on certain adjectives. He'd come home from a movie, a scary movie, and say to him, you know, Johnny, that's not his name, but Johnny, how was the movie? Oh, it was all full of monsters and horrible things, and I was frightening. And any native speaker of English knows that that's not what you should have said, and no native speaker would have put it that way. They would have said, and I was frightened. He's putting the wrong end, but we all understood what he meant. We're not going to make a fuss of it, right? The culture ballgame rules are equally there. They're hidden from our own consciousness. But when people violate our cultural rules, we're not nearly so lenient. That was rude. That was stupid. That was inappropriate. That was mean. This is how my kids are assessed by the incoming teachers. What's wrong with these kids means they're not playing our ball game. They're violating our ball game rules on a regular, consistent basis. And they act as if they're doing it on purpose just to irritate the teacher. That's not it at all. The kids are playing their ball game, so to speak, the way they always have, and the way everybody in the village has done for thousands of years. Metaphorically speaking, it's as if the village plays basketball. But basketball is the only game they know. And they know how to dribble when it comes to basketball. They know how to take the ball and bounce it with their hand. That's what everyone they've ever known does. When you say play ball, for that people in that community, it means basketball. It's the only game they know. It's the only game they've ever seen. The teachers are like a bunch of people who also play ball, but the ball game they play is soccer. They've never seen any other game. And they come into this community, and they see these kids bouncing the ball with their hand. What's wrong with these kids? Don't they know how to play ball? Because as soccer players, what they're doing is completely wrong, out of bounds, illegal. Touch the ball with your hand, free kick for the other team. So the teachers come in to the classroom, so metaphorically speaking, and say, who will dribble for me? And the kids all know how to dribble, but it's this way, right? And the teachers are saying, did you see that? What's wrong with these kids? There's nothing wrong with those kids. They're playing their own ball game. A ball game, however, the teachers have never seen. And their behavior looks deviant because they only know soccer. I do this deliberately with my class in the high school. I use this very word, in this case, dribble. And I say to the teenagers, pretend I'm from another planet. I've just come to Earth. I understand you human beings do this thing called play ball. And I have a ball here. I don't know what to do with it. But I understand that one thing you do with the ball is dribble it. Will someone come forward and please dribble the ball for me? And inevitably, one of the boys will come up and bounce it. Okay. And then I said to the class, is that how you would, everybody agrees that's the way to dribble? But there's always some soccer player in the room. And they say, no, Father Michael, that's not what I would have done if you asked me to dribble. Okay, will you come forward and dribble for me? And of course, they'll kick it from foot to foot. And then I say, what's the right way to dribble? And the basketball team will all say, the right way to dribble is the way we did it. Every time. So wait a minute. How about the other guys? No. There's not one right way to dribble. It depends what ball game you're playing. Right. And what's appropriate in one ball game is not necessarily allowed. In fact, it could be forbidden in another. But that doesn't make basketball right and soccer wrong. You just got to know which ball game you're playing. To extend this a bit, there are different kinds of ball games. My parents argued for nearly 60 years about this, and I didn't realize that it was simply because my mother was playing the ball game of life the way she was raised, and my father was playing the ball game of life the way he was raised. We pick up these ball game rules, I repeat, the same time we learn our language. It's in the first 2 or 3 years of life. And then when those grammatical rules are there, they're there permanently. You don't reconsider them. But the same thing is true for our cultural rules. What I mean was, my mother was raised in what I call the German ball game. It's the German ball game because, like many ball games, that culture and many others believe that the ball game of life is a timed event. You know what I mean? Football, hockey, basketball, soccer all have clocks. And the clock is an important part of the game. If you didn't have a clock, you wouldn't know when it was over. And if you couldn't tell when it was over, you couldn't tell who won. And especially as we play, you know, March Madness, the last seconds of the game, after hours of play, it's the last seconds that will ultimately determine who will win the whole tournament. You got to know about how to use the clock to your advantage, when to call timeout and when not to, when to keep the play going and when to slow it down. The clock is an important part of the whole strategy of the game. The game of life in some cultures is like that. The clock determines the schedule. The clock determines what will happen and when. We have it on a schedule, it's published, it's in the newspaper, it's in the church bulletin, whatever it is, and we follow it. That's the kind of ball game, the timed game. But not all games are timed. In the German culture, if someone says to you, and I mean Pennsylvania German here, not necessarily in Germany, if someone says to you, we'd like to invite you to dinner, come at 6 o'clock. In that culture, you know exactly what that means. 5:55 at the latest. Late in this culture is out of bounds. Late is inappropriate. Late is rude. Late is inconsiderate. Actually, late is sinful. People go to hell for late. It's absolutely inexcusable to be late. Why? Because the people who have taken all day long to cook the meal for you, they made homemade noodles. They're making schnitzel at 10 in the morning, right? They have worked all day, and they expect you to arrive. Your only duty as the guest is to come on time. Because they have planned the meal. They've done mathematical computations. They will arrive at 6. We will take their coats and hang them up between 6:01 and 6:03. By 6:04, we'll be at the table. By 6:05, we'll say grace and sit down. 6:06, we need the first course. It'll be soup almost inevitably, which means that the cooks, knowing that you will arrive on time, or at least expecting you to arrive at 6, at 5:44, turn the burner on low under the soup. So that at 6:06, it will be ready for serving in the tureen, bring it to the table and dish it out. This will take 10 minutes. So now we're down to 6:16, everybody has their soup. 6:17, we need the rolls or the bread hot from the oven. But to have the rolls hot from the oven meant that during the subtraction, you had to put the rolls in at 4:32, but the oven took 15 minutes to preheat. So doing some more subtraction, you had to, you see what I'm saying? The whole thing is a mathematical computation. And if the meal is properly served according to plan, at 8:30, it will be done. You will have eaten the entire meal, and you will go home on schedule. The invitation could even say dinner from 6 to 8:30. And it's like with military strategy. Everything is done according to plan, and a good meal happens exactly as preconceived in the mind of the hosts. That's a German meal. That's how my mother served dinners. If we had to go someplace, she did the math. It's going to take probably 20 minutes to get there. God forbid we should be late. We better leave 25 minutes early just in case there's traffic or something that slows us down. So every family excursion we ever went on, my mother had done the math. She was riding shotgun. The three kids, myself, my brother and sister, are in the back seat. However, this is where the conflict in ball games inevitably occurred. It's time to leave according to my mother's calculations. But the driver, Dad, where is he? He's in the shower. He hasn't even started to get ready. I heard this all my life. There's something wrong with your father. It wasn't just the teachers in Alaska. It was my own father at home who was being accused of something wrong with. Now, what's the problem here? Well, my father wasn't raised in a German-American neighborhood. He wasn't even raised in a city where clocks matter. He was raised in the country. Country people actually don't care for clocks all that much. To be honest, I've lived in rural Alaskan communities for most of my life now. The basic unit of time in the city is the hour and any fraction of it. And that's because city people, living with so many others, need to make schedules. You can't just say, I think I'll have lunch with my friend tomorrow. The friend has to know. And you have to call them up and say, let's meet at such and such a restaurant at such and such a time. Otherwise, in a city of 100,000 people, it would be hit or miss. You'd never find your friend. You've got to arrange these things. That's why clocks were invented. And by the way, let's think about this. Who invented the 60-second minute, the 60-minute hour, and the 24-hour day? Historically, where did that come from? It's not in nature, right? Who says it had to be 60? Why not 40? Why not 80? Why not 100? How come seconds are... And that, who decided how long a second should be? How many seconds are in a minute? It's purely a mathematical construction of the ancient Babylonians. They had the first cities, and then they bequeathed this system to other city dwellers for all time in the future. In other words, it's something else we can blame the Iraqis for. Because it's a city phenomenon. Now, my father not living in a city, not being born in a city. Farm people, rural people, village people, their unit of time is not the hour. The hour is an abstraction they care not to deal with. In a village, on a farm, the basic unit of time is the day. If it happened that day, it was on time. The sun comes up, the sun goes down. Pretty simple. Huh? And I've lived in, the last village I lived in was a population of 212, mostly Yupik Eskimo people. 100 miles away from the main city or town from which we get all our supplies, our mail, our groceries, most of our passengers and gas, they come from Dillingham. It's 99 miles away. On the schedule, on the web, Peninsula Airways has two flights a day to our village. It's on the schedule, you can see. There's a 9 o'clock plane that gets to our village at 10. And there's a 2 o'clock plane that gets to our village at 3. Every day, year round. Doesn't change. But in the history of aviation, the 9 o'clock plane, in fact, has never left at 9 o'clock. And in the history of world aviation, the 2 o'clock plane also has never left at 2. If they both get to our village that day, they're on time. Nobody says you're late. It's never been said. They got there, don't complain. That was my father's worldview, my father's culture. And my mother constantly criticized as something wrong with. And then I lived for a year in Moscow. One of my colleagues at the university said, we're having a name day party. It's St. Dimitri Day. Come December, November, whatever the date was. Come for our son Dimitri's name day, 7 o'clock Thursday evening. Of course, we'll be glad to come, 7 o'clock. But my mother's upbringing and my own culture brought me to the doors of their apartment at 6:50. Because God forbid I should be late. It's been ingrained in me. There's something wrong with your father. He's always late. Don't be late and so forth. We got this lecture all the time. So I show up 10 minutes before the appointment. According to my mother's upbringing and my own culture, I'm on time. We knock on the door, ring the doorbell. Our host, Now we're in Moscow. Our Russian host comes to the door. It's 10 minutes supposedly before the meal. He doesn't look like he's ready to eat. He's all sweaty. His hair's disheveled. He's wearing a spattered apron. He opens the door and looks rather perplexed at my wife and me. We get this look. And I respond with, Праздник сегодня, правда? The party's today, right? Да, 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 заходите, пожалуйста. Yes, 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 come on in. And my wife and I are escorted to a holding area. There's food, there's zakuski, finger food, there's beverages, alcoholic and non. And we get seated there, and our host, the cook, goes back to the kitchen. The doorbell doesn't ring for another hour and a quarter. It's 8:15 before anybody else shows up. What's wrong with these people? And I'm thinking, it's just like Dad. It is just like Dad. It's exactly what my father would have done. Show up an hour after the appointed time. Isn't that rude? Isn't that inconsiderate? That's what I was taught in my ball game. Those are the rules. Then you have to interview the Muscovites. Why didn't they come at 7 o'clock? It wouldn't have crossed their mind to come at 7 o'clock. No, never would have thought of that would be rude. How could coming on time be rude? The ballgame rules are different. When a Russian says 7 o'clock, it doesn't mean the same as when a German says 7 o'clock. It's like animal and animal. It's like dribble and dribble. They mean two totally different things. We know what it means in the German culture. No later than. In the Russian culture, it takes a paragraph to explain. 7 o'clock, when the host says, come at 7 o'clock, this is what they really mean. I'm going to unlock my front door so that anyone can come in at any time after 7. And we don't really expect you to come at 7 because, you know, every day has its glitches. Nothing goes according to plan. There's always some mishap or problem or emergency that needs to be attended to. And besides, the meal has no game plan whatsoever. We'll start when you all get here, anytime after 7. Now, if you put it that way, you don't show up at 6:50. I'm playing the German ball game in Moscow. It's just like playing soccer on the basketball court. It doesn't work. And what you think are the right, proper rules are a complete violation of the rules. So you got to know a new ball game. The ball game here, the German ball game, the German meal was carefully planned to the minute. The Russian ball game has no particular plan at all because we don't know when people are actually going to show up. When they're all finally here, we'll come to the table. It might be 9 o'clock already. The German ball game, the German meal's already done. The Russian ball game's just getting started. Because you don't know ahead of time who's actually going to show up. Some people you invited might not come. They won't call, they won't tell you, they just won't be there. Other things came up, that's okay. No apologies necessary. But those who did, one of them is the professor of Russian literature. How do you know ahead of time when he will feel moved to stand at the head of the table and recite for 20 minutes a poem by Pushkin? You don't know that. You don't know when he's going to do that. And when he does, when he's done, we have to applaud and drink toast to poets, professors of poetry, and of course Pushkin himself. That's going to take time. How do you know who's going to bring their accordion or their violin or their saxophone, and open the case in the middle of the meal, and we'll start playing. And people will get up from the table and dance in the parlor for half an hour, and then come back. How do you know when that's going to happen? How do you know when someone won't burst into a Russian folk song, and everybody joins in? And how do you know ahead of time how many verses they're actually going to sing? There's no way to know. The ball game, it's like baseball, tennis, golf. There is no clock. The clock has no there's no purpose to a clock. The clock doesn't tell you when the baseball game is going to be over. There's no way to tell how long a baseball game will last because the clock has nothing to do with baseball. It's a timeless game, a game without a clock. Russian culture is a game without a clock. I've been at parties that went into the next day. Oh, people fell asleep about 2, 3 in the morning. But they got up at 5 or 6, 7 or 8 the next morning and resumed. We said at dinner tonight, Ukrainian breakfast, it's whatever was on the table from the night before. Because we just start right in where we left off. And I've been to weddings that have lasted 4 days and 3 nights. That's a wedding, by the way. And they could, and what is the other part? We look along our ball game, going back to my beam of light idea, and we look at others. And when we look at others, we critique it in terms of ours. And then we always come off pretty good. But you see, that's really not fair. The only way to understand somebody else's culture is at least to make an attempt to peek into their beam of light. Or to watch them play their ball game by their own rules and learn to appreciate it. That's what you have to do cross-culturally. You can't criticize the way these people play your game because they're not playing your game. There's nothing wrong with those people. But your ball game may be a timed event, and their ball game, like baseball or tennis, may not. And in my parish in Anchorage, where we had Romanians, Greeks, Albanians, Eskimos, Aleuts, most of them believe the ball game of life does not have a clock. So you start the liturgy, and only half the people are there. Those with large German blood quantums. Meanwhile, they do know that we're starting on time. But those with babies know they can't hold that baby for 2 hours. We have to allow for that. Now, I do believe that people should be at the beginning of liturgy. There's no reason. I was in a Romanian parish in Bridgeport, Connecticut, when I was in seminary, and we would get a bit frustrated, what's wrong with these people, because until Holy God, there was a skeleton crew. Often just one cantor who got through the antiphons. By the time we got to Sfinte Dumnezeule, Holy God, Holy Mighty, the choir would usually burst in and join us. I think something should be said about that. They could come 10 minutes. We're talking about 10 minutes earlier. But it was their pattern, their habit, maybe not a good habit, maybe not a good pattern. If I were the priest, I would have taken them aside, at least a few of them, and said, can't we just start liturgy together at Blessed is the Kingdom? Why bother to come 10 minutes late? Just come 10 minutes earlier. I would have done that. But I understand that culturally, on time does not mean the same thing from one culture to the next. Just like animal, just like my other examples, dribble, the same word can mean different things to different people. And in their ball game, that's how it's played. And here's maybe the last point on this. It's the way it's played, and because it's the way they learned in infancy, the same time they learned their language, that's the way their hard drive works. It's not on a floppy disk. It's not on something you can pull out and put back in. That's the way you could say they're wired. My father never changed in 63 years of marriage. Drove my mother crazy. But you see, and he wasn't doing it to spite her. That's the ball game of life as he played it. That's the way he saw the world. And I have become much more accepting of my father, having lived in Russia for a year, than I was when I was a kid, and believe what my mother was saying, there's something wrong with Dad. And I think, from my point of view, I'm much happier with my father to believe that he sees the world the way he was raised, and he plays the ball game of life the way he was taught, and like I said, it's on his program, it's the way he's wired. And no matter what you do, no matter how much you criticize or badger or threaten, it's not going to change his wiring. We just have to accept these things about people as different from us. And there may be better. I think coming to church on time is better. But I could go up to the Romanian lady Sunday after Sunday and say, why were you late again? You know what will happen? She'll go to another church. We're not going to change her wiring. She's going to feel like I'm constantly putting her down and insulting her. She's not be conscious of any of this. You're not conscious of your grammatical rules. You're also not conscious of your cultural rules. But you don't want to be criticized for playing the ball game of life the way you, your parents, and your whole community has always played it. So we have to accept this about folks. So my first definition, you recall, the way you see the world, the shed. Second definition, the ballgame of life as you play it. The third one, however, is, I think, the most helpful. Your culture is, in the end, also the story into which you were born. Specifically, the story into which you were born. Not just any story. The story into which you were born. In other words, you don't invent your culture. It's already there before you come along. If you want to understand your culture, think of it as a story in which your grandparents have written most of their chapter before you were born. Your parents have written at least half of the next chapter before you came along. You are chapter 3, not chapter 1. Your children become chapter 4, and your grandchildren become chapter 5, and the story keeps going. So what will chapter 5, your grandchildren, know about chapter 1, your grandparents? Only what you tell them. Because you are likely to be the only person who, hopefully, knew some of your grandparents on one hand and will live to see some of your grandchildren on the other. They're never going to know everything about your grandparents. They probably wouldn't be that interested, actually. But there are certain things about the family history that need to be passed down. I don't know a lot about my mother's parents. They both died before I was born. I know some things about them. I know about their careers. I know how they made a living. But what was the sound of their voice? How kind or gentle or loving or generous would they have been to me? I'll never know. That part of the story has been, you know, unfortunately, never happened. On my father's side, I know a lot because my grandmother lived to be 90-something. So she's chapter 1 in my story. And I don't know everything about her. Of course, no one knows everything about anybody. But I do know the basic outline. She was born in what was, in her age, it was Austro-Hungarian Empire. Today, as Europe has changed its boundaries like 5 times since then, her village, if it survived, would be in southeast Poland, but just barely. About 10 miles south of her village today is Slovakia, and about 20 miles to the east of her village would be Ukraine. So she's in this crossroads. A few miles this way, a few miles that way, it would today be a different nationality. The important part, however, isn't that. The important part is that there was no school in her village. So no one, not her parents, not anybody that she knew in the family, could read or write. It didn't matter. You're a subsistence farmer. You slop your hogs, you feed your chickens, you milk your cows, you bake your own bread, you gather your own eggs, you chop your own wood, you brew your own vodka, and you live on your own resources. In fact, these are people, as I see it, these are the people whose culture the hippies were trying to emulate in the 1960s. Pretty much independent, self-motivated, and self-energizing people. Because to this day, it's still like that. All right. But my grandmother never learned to read and write because there was no school. And then she got a letter. At the age of 15, she got a letter. There are always parts of the family stories that are missing. This is part of the story that's missing. The aunts who sent her the letter were already living in this place called Pennsylvania. I don't know how they got there. My grandmother didn't know how they got there. They got there a generation before that, in the 1870s or 1880s. This is now about 1900, and she gets a letter. Nobody can read it. They had to find somebody in the village who could read. The letter basically said something like this: we're making good money over here in America, and your oldest daughter, Anna, next year will be old enough to immigrate. She doesn't have to live here the rest of her life, but she can come over to Pennsylvania, wherever that is, and we'll get her a job. She can live with us in the same house, in the same boarding house, and she can send money home to help the family if she's willing to come. We're willing to sponsor her. That's pretty much the gist of the letter. So somebody in the village had to read that, and then also for a couple of kopecks, write the response. So the answer is, Anna, are you willing to go to America? She never went to school. She didn't know where America was, how far away it would be, right? For whatever reason, sounded like an adventure. She said yes. I wouldn't be here if she hadn't said yes that fateful day in Austro-Hungary 100 years ago. And he went, a year later, when she was 16, they sent her the passage, the tickets. She got train tickets to cross Poland and Germany, and she got boat passage from Bremen to New York. Now, her father put her on the train, and she says he cried when he said goodbye to his 16-year-old, his oldest, his firstborn. But he didn't go with her. She didn't speak Polish. She didn't speak German. She couldn't read or write. How she got on the right train and found the right boat, I don't know. She must have had somebody's help. Then she spent weeks on the boat crossing the Atlantic Ocean. And finally, the Statue of Liberty. On the 50th anniversary of her arrival, I took her to New York, and she saw the Statue of Liberty for the second time. And immediately it provoked the story, what it was like to cross the ocean, seeing the Statue of Liberty. She said, I was so happy to see the Statue of Liberty. We called her Baba, of course. Baba, did you know what it was? She said, I had no idea what it was. Well, then why were you so happy? She said, I was so seasick. I knew I was finally going to get off that blinking boat. And her aunts met her and took her to this factory job in Northampton, Pennsylvania. And she was miserably homesick. Now, skip ahead 50 years. I'm with her. She's in her 90s. She's walking very slowly across the grass, the lawn, at the parish cemetery. We're going to visit my grandfather's grave, her husband. And halfway there, she stopped. And she turned back to me and said, in her thick Slavic accent, you know, Michael, I marry your grandfather because he promised to take me home. She took a few more steps, stopped again, turned to me and said, and then he died, the bum. He not only died, he left her with four kids and a small farm during the Depression. And the police come knocking on the door, rather violently, I would say, and she admits the state troopers to her kitchen. And they began scolding her. Mrs. Oleksa, you're breaking the law, Nirozumiu, don't understand. School, Mrs. Oleksa. Ah, school. In Ukraine, in her language, shkol. Shkol, shkola. Close enough. She got it. School. Oh, this is about school. Just a minute. She went back into her bedroom. She brought out her purse and dumped the contents on the table. To demonstrate she'd had no money to send people to school. In the old country, there's no free school. You have to pay tuition. You have to pay fees. It's still true in most of the world. There's no free school. She never got to go to school, not only because there was no building called Shkola in the village, there wouldn't have been any money to pay for it anyway. So they're scolding her. She got the idea. It has something to do with school. I have no money. So she dumps the contents of her purse on the table, and she says, you know, I can't do it. Не можу. I can't. There's no money. And they, I don't know how they would have done this, the troopers or the police, they had to convey to my grandmother a completely new concept that in America, everybody goes to school, and you don't pay. You don't have to pay the teacher every day tuition or fees. You don't have to buy the books. Everyone goes to school and it's free. This is a mind-changing, world-changing concept. In America, everyone goes to school and you don't pay? What a country! And my Aunt Mary, now 97 years old, and my dad, who would have been 95 today, it's his birthday, were the first Oleksas ever sent na shkolu. Preceded by a little lecture my grandmother gave them that went something like this. You kids are so lucky to be born in America. If we'd gone back to Europe like your father and I had planned, there'd be no school for you. You'll be illiterate like me. But in America, they make you go to school, and it's free. I want you to take advantage of this. Do your best. Work hard. Respect your teacher. Don't disgrace us. If I find out you were misbehaving, if I find out you got into trouble at school, I'm warning you now. Whatever punishment they give you there, when you get home, it's going to be much worse. How do I know that lecture so well? I'll tell you. The night before I left home for kindergarten, that was the story my father told at the supper table. I submit to you that that defines school to me. It's not in the dictionary. The story into which I was born defines the word school. My grandmother never got to go for one day. My father went to school, got a high school diploma, and was drafted into the Army during World War II. But he got a high school diploma. And I, the next generation, and it wasn't just me, the next generation, my sister, brother, and all my 11 cousins, it was expected by Baba and by our parents, we were going to college. In fact, at my grandmother's funeral, I even asked my cousins, did you ever think of not going to college? And they looked at me like, what you talking about? It hadn't even crossed our minds. We knew that Baba had never gone to school, that our parents had made it through high school, secondary education, diplomas, and that we were expected, chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. And chapter three all went to college, by the way, and my grandmother lived to see all 13 of her grandchildren with college diplomas. That's our story. It's the story you're born into, and you actually don't even think about it or critique it until you look back. And you say, yeah, I guess we did have the option not to go to college. Our parents would have been shocked. We could have got around that. We shocked our parents plenty of times. But we could have never faced Baba. You see what I'm saying? That's your culture. It's the story into which you were born. My wife's story is totally different. About 100 years ago, the federal government decided that the native people of Alaska needed schools. They didn't ask the native people about this, they just decided, right? So one fine day on the open tundra of western Alaska, a barge came up the river and unloaded about a ton of lumber on the riverbank. This was something of an event. People came out to watch, and then they weren't quite sure what this stuff was. We have driftwood that comes down the river, but this was all evenly cut, smooth boards. The elders weren't quite sure what it, they ran their hands across it. They knocked their knuckles against it, and muhrak, it's wood. They understood now, muhrak. Someone brought us all this wood. Makikataktakut. Translation, big sauna tonight. And I'm sure that those boards disappeared for all kinds of other village purposes before the carpenters came to build a schoolhouse about half the size of this church. One room schoolhouse, one window, one door. And as the carpenters were building this, the real people, the Yupik Eskimos, were asking, what is this that you're doing? Chalichi, what are you building? And they answered, school. This brought the word skulok into the Yupik vocabulary, but they still had no idea what it was. They built the school building in my wife's village over the village well. It saved the Bureau of Indian Affairs the cost of digging another well. So what's a skulok? Apparently it's a big pointed wooden thing that sits on your water supply. People still have no idea what this is for. Then the teachers arrive. We're talking 1890s, early 1900s. You can imagine how strange these creatures looked. People used to talk to me about the first teachers they ever saw. The man disembarked with a handlebarred mustache that made him look something like Azavuk, an animal we're familiar with, walrus. And he seemed to be very wealthy because he was covered with money, buttons. Originally, people used shells, then beads, and finally, buttons were used as currency. People decorated their costumes with buttons. The Tlingits have something called a button blanket. It's all white, abalone kind of buttons, and designs are made, and people wear it in their clan design, but it's made of buttons. Buttons were like money. This guy's covered in money. He has buttons on his vest, buttons on his jacket, buttons up his sleeve. His shoes are spats. They're covered. Hundreds of buttons. People look at him and wonder, how long does it take him to get dressed? But they're distracted by his wife. She's even more amazing. She disembarks with a parasol in the style of the fashion of the day, which blows inside out with the first good gust of local wind. exposing a hairdo like nobody had ever seen. All her hair is piled up on top of her head. She looks something like Homer Simpson's wife Marge. And then besides all that, there's something wrong with her posterior. It sticks way out. The real people gawk, wondering, could that be real? No one dares ask or check. A few days later, Mrs. Fat Fanny goes outside, stands in front of the skulok, the pointed angular building, and begins making all this clanging noise. The lang, the lang, the lang. Now the real people are looking out their doors and windows. What is Fat Fanny doing now? And they go back to sleep. Nobody knows they're supposed to send their kids up to this weird building, and the kids don't want to go in there. Now, we know because of protests and letters sent by school teachers from all over Alaska to the Department of Education at this time, 100 years ago, they begin complaining about these people and how we rang the bell and nobody came. So obviously, they don't care about education. They don't care about the education and the future of their children, these people. Cross-cultural breakdown already in progress. But we can't let this slide. The teachers take matters in their own hands. They hide in the bushes. They wait for the kids to come out to play. And when a few of them are in with pouncing distance, they grab them, haul them up to the school, push them through the door and lock it, and go on the prowl for more pupils. Using this technique, they eventually abduct all the kids in the village. They have them now corralled in the skulok, and they make them sit down. They didn't have separate desks or seats. They had benches, low benches for the smaller children, middle size and taller for the biggest kids. Once all the seats are filled, time to start school. The teacher stands before the class with the bell in her hand. Boys and girls, she says in perfectly clear English, when I ring this bell, all of you come here. Charade seems to work. The kids nod. Okay, we got it. What she cannot convey to them, even to this day, is the adverb immediately. They still understand that as long as they come to school that day, it's going to be okay. Secondly, the teacher says, there's another rule here. Listen up. You must not speak your native language on school property during school hours. She says this to all of them in perfectly clear English, which not one of them understands. And there's no charades for this. So Johnny, Ivan, and Nikolai in the front row are five-year-old boys, kindergarten class. The benches are uncomfortable. And one says to the other, Chamakanakta, Tarinstikatanka. Translation, what she's saying, I can't understand her. Violating school rule number two. Mrs. Fat Fanny comes over to those still little boys and slaps them both across the mouth. The rest of the class gets quiet for the next 7 years. They're never quite sure why those kids, they've never seen a child get slapped. There's no physical punishment in Yupik culture, but these kids got slapped in the face. The others are horrified. What did they do? Maybe you're not supposed to turn your head so far. So they sit like statues, staring straight ahead and saying nothing. And understanding nothing. I asked my wife, who went to exactly such a school, what was that like? She said it wasn't so bad. We used to play school at recess. You played school at recess. What you do, go outside and slap each other around for 20 minutes? She says, no. We sat in rows in the snow or on the ground. And the play teacher stood before the others and went, and we'd pretend to speak English too, and we'd raise our heads and we'd go, that was school. When did you start to learn anything? Fourth grade. You sat through first, second, and third grade understanding nothing at all, learning nothing at all. Just to keep the teachers happy, you showed up and sat there, but you understood and learned nothing for 3 years. What kids would do that today? Pretty much none of them, but that's what it was. And yet, out of that school experience, where the word skulok meant abuse, attack on your identity, your language, your culture, Out of that school experience, my wife, her sister, and brother all have college degrees. Who are the greater heroes? Who overcame more obstacles? I say school, you say school, though, but what does school mean? It depends on your story. And so, no wonder the teachers today still are burdened with this negative idea of what happens at school. School is the place where they attack you, where they criticize you for playing the only ball game you know, where they wash out your mouth with soap for speaking the only language you know. Why would you go back? And many didn't, of course. And those that did and persevered were taken off to boarding schools where they were physically and sexually abused, and again beaten for speaking the only language they knew, and again persecuted for being who they were. And I would say, I only taught 1 year at a Bureau of Indian Affairs school. That was back in 71, 72. Most of my students from those schools did not live to be 30. Many of them committed suicide. Others drank or took drugs. Others were involved in perfectly preventable accidents. Less than half survived to the age of 30. What are we doing to our children? You know, another culture would have burned the schools down. And I mentioned this to a Yupik man not long ago. I said, you know what we need is a Yupik riot. He said, there is one, but it's silent. Because our people are humble and quiet, and they won't commit acts of violence, and they're allergic to conflict. And so this goes on for 100 years. I say school, you say school. I say on time, you say on time. Can we talk? You see, I believe that the only thing we really can do because of all these different stories is to have the respect and put in the time and the energy to precisely hear each other's stories. And I wouldn't say not my personal biography and yours. Let's start with chapter one. And I do this with public school teachers as well as locals. Tell me a story about your grandparents. Because that will give me some sense of where you're coming from. And I do this in my college class, and I get some extraordinary... It's perfectly random. There's only 30, 40 students. It takes one full evening, 3-4 hours, for us to get around the room and everybody share just one grandparent story. And it's always amazing. We laugh, we cry. We hear the tragedies that some families have dealt with and overcome, the traumas that they've suffered. But we also hear their triumphs, the wonderful things that they've accomplished. Sometimes after all that sadness comes some real rebirth and renaissance, rebirth and progress. So just sitting around and talking. It used to be called, when I was a kid, visiting. Families visited, aunts and uncles came over, and what did they do? There was nothing worthwhile touch on television. We didn't have 500 channels. We might have had three, but there was nothing good on, especially on a Sunday. Until Bonanza came on in color, that was different. But families visited. The kids went out to play, and the adults sat around and reminisced. And they told those who had just married into the family all the funny stories about the man they had just married. And the family history was told and rehearsed and laughed about and cried about, but it's what human beings do. They empathize with each other and they listen to the stories. I think that's the great tragedy of maybe the 21st century. We're texting now, but we're not even asking for those stories. The stories are being forgotten and lost. What's the story? There's a story for this parish, the people who have been here. Your story, my story, your grandparents, my grandparents. Unfortunately, we don't spend the time anymore. We have all these time-saving devices, but it's a kind of deception, isn't it? We have less time now to ourselves than we ever did before. We're busier than ever before. But in any case, I'm just pointing out that in an Alaskan village, most of the time, what people are doing is visiting and telling stories. The way human beings lived for the last, I don't know, thousands of years is still preserved in small rural communities. If I ever left and came to this part of the world again, I know I would miss that. Because here we're strangers to each other, and we don't spend the time to hear the stories from each of our families. And we therefore don't know each other very in any kind of depth. But villages, everybody knows everybody, and we've known each other all our lives. And it makes a cohesive human community where people really know and care about each other. I don't know how we reconstitute that in the modern world, but that's what a culture is. My final point on this topic, if there's a loss of culture in the modern world, it's in the developed sector. In the second and third world, and certainly in rural places like Alaska, the culture is well. People know the story. People are still telling the story, and people are still enacting the story. When I ask my class, in the high school level, we have the most culturally diverse high schools in the United States. We have kids from every place. More than 90 languages spoken in the public schools of Anchorage, Alaska. That's pretty phenomenal. When I ask the class, next week we're going to tell grandpa stories. The immigrant kids are bursting. They can't wait to tell you. It turns out grandchildren are as excited to talk about their grandparents as grandparents are to brag about their grandchildren. So the immigrant kids, they can't wait. The indigenous kids, the tribal kids, the native kids, they can't wait. The majority kids are looking blankly at me and at each other. When is this due? Because they're the ones who don't know. I find that tragic. But if that's the majority, then that's going to become the norm in the next generation or two. And we're going to be human beings with no history and no family stories. I find that terribly dehumanizing. I don't know if we can really be people who don't know where we came from. And it's especially true for people who have faced difficulties, tragedies, and some really hard times, because they're the ones who got through it, and that makes them strong. I invite parents to my class, my high school class. It's my last story on this topic. And one class in particular, there was an African-American man who came, and he had an amazing story that doesn't take too long, so I want to share it with you. This is a story completely off my radar screen. I didn't have any African-American friends in high school. There weren't any. I was in a pretty white town when I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania. There weren't a lot of African-American, there weren't a lot of black people. There was one black kid in my high school that I can remember. Everybody knew his name, but nobody was his friend. You know what I mean? Because he was the minority. But did he connect with anybody? I don't, not that I know of. In any case, this man came to my class and he said, I came to tell you a story, not about my grandmother, but what my grandmother told me about her grandmother. Now do the math. He's born about 1950. His grandmother's born about 1890. Her grandmother would have been born in 1830-something. Right? Just counting backwards. No, an African-American woman in 1830, you understand her status. She was living in this state, come to think of it. This didn't cross my mind till just now. She was living in Georgia. And her master told her that she was being sold, that her new owner was coming to fetch her tomorrow. Now, what does that mean to a slave woman in the rural South 100 years ago, 200 years ago now? It means she'll never see her husband, her children, or her family again. And she has no choice. And she's being taken to Alabama. So what does a woman do? She can't run away. If she ran away, she still wouldn't see her husband, her kids, or her family. So that's not a solution. And she'd probably be caught and punished. So what she did that night before dawn, before the new owner came, she sneaked out to the barn on this plantation and chopped off her left hand. That solved the problem. The new owner didn't want a one-handed slave. The deal was off, and she got to stay. But I'd never heard a story like that, right? And I said to this man, what does that story mean to your family? He said, that story makes my family strong and proud. That's the sacrifice my grandmother's grandmother made to keep the family together. With a little smirk, he turned to me and said, so don't mess with my kids. But you see, when you ask people of different cultural backgrounds to tell their stories, you don't know what you're going to get. But it's always amazing what human beings have endured, what trials and tribulations they have gotten through, and what problems they've solved. And it makes you proud to be a human being. Because some of their courage, some of their creativity, whatever it is, you say, wow, what people are capable of. And you can appreciate these people whose stories are not at all like yours. So this third definition of culture I recommend to you. It's something we can do as parishes. Sit around and tell grandpa stories one night. Come another night and just tell grandma stories. And share the story into which you were born. And that will be the most excellent cross-cultural communication we can do. That's the end of this theme. How much more time do I have, if any?
We might be up to questions.
Okay. So, anybody have any comments or questions on what I've monologued about for so long? Father Marcus?
Does the church provide us with a story?
I think so. It's a great, great comment. I think our story that all Orthodox share is the story we all embrace in the anaphora. That's our common Orthodox story. Thou art God, ineffable, inconceivable, invisible, incomprehensible, ever eternally the same. Thou and thine only begotten Son. And what? You brought us from non-existence into being. And when we had fallen away, you raised us up and endowed us with your kingdom, which is to come. Of course, that's John Chrysostom. That's our story. That's the story we all embrace and the story we all share. That's our culture. And we celebrate our story and our culture every time we gather to celebrate the liturgy. And then we do it with vigor during Holy Week and Pascha. And there's certain things about our story that we not only tell the story, but we celebrate our story. What else is the church but the celebration of our story? The enacting of our story, the reminding of our story. The burial of Christ on Great and Holy Friday and the lamentations at the tomb. That's our story. And then there comes that incredibly joyful moment at Pascha. Certain things that we look forward to that are only done like once a year. And we come to church to celebrate that and to participate in that. Christ is risen and the demons are fallen. Christ is risen and the angels rejoice. Christ is risen and not one dead remains in the tombs. That's our story. And we share the joy of that story. And that binds us together. In a sense, that's the way we see the world. And we learn to play the ball game of life according to that story. I think that that may be unique in Christendom, that we Orthodox still have a story and we know what it is.
Well, Father, you're one of the few people in the room who is not a convert. For most of us, a convert, that story has become our story.
That's right. That's right, exactly. That's right.
I was talking to some people recently who are coming into Orthodoxy, you know, and eventually one of their children is adopted, and she really lit up when I mentioned to her that as Christians, we're all adopted.
We're all adopted.
We're all adopted,
right,
by
right.
God. And that explained a lot of things.
Of course, yeah, that's right. And even though I was baptized Orthodox, I wasn't raised Orthodox. I had to decide to come to the Orthodox Church and affiliate myself, attach myself back to it when I was a teenager. So, but in a certain sense, that's true for all of us. Even if you're cradle Orthodox, as they say, you have to ultimately decide whether you're going to accept that story as your story or not. And we are free in this country to not. Meanwhile, in other countries, it's pretty much automatic to be Greek and to be Orthodox, because there was Orthodoxy before there was Greece. And there was Orthodoxy before there was Russia. And there was the people were Orthodox before there was a Ukraine. That was their story before there was a national story. There was the story of their conversion to the Orthodox faith. For Serbians, it's by family, and they have their Slavas, and you celebrate when our family got adopted, or when the family adopted the story. You can look at it either way, but it's absolutely true. I think you're right. And then that word adopted means something really positive, doesn't it? And for the adopted kid, but we're all adopted children of God. It's a nice thing to point out. But I do think we have a story. And like any tribe, we have ceremonies that bring the story to life. That's what the tribal ceremonies always are. There's a time of the year when you tell that story, you sing those songs and do those dances, and you bring that story to consciousness and celebrate it. And then there's another part of year when you do a different story and you celebrate and sing the songs related to that, and you bring that story to life and you celebrate. What else is the church's feast days? What else are we doing now with Lent, Holy Week, and Pascha? With the Orthodox tribe. And that pattern of telling the story and then singing about it and celebrating it is exactly the way human beings have lived for tens of thousands of years. We're just the Orthodox tribe who have our songs, our ceremonies, and our dances, but they're universal and everyone's invited to our tribe. No one is excluded. Christ is risen and not one dead remains in the tombs. We're not just celebrating the resurrection of our own dead, the Christian dead. We're celebrating the death of death for everybody. No one's excluded from the empty tomb. But they don't know it yet. So we have to tell them. Then the saints become the real human beings. The saints are those who have, following Christ as their paradigm, as their model, do their best to imitate him, what Christ would say, what Christ would do. We can't do it by ourselves, so Christ himself comes to us and into us sacramentally to help us achieve that goal. But we're all like spokes on the wheel, different wires, but there's a hub. And each of us in our own life is moving toward that hub until we're all joined together in him, in his kingdom. We all start as separate spokes. But as Christians, we're all headed in the same direction toward the center. And the saints are those who have arrived and have become Christ-like people. And now we're the church of God, as St. Paul writes to the Corinthians, called to be saints ourselves. He wrote it to the Corinthians. Yeah. We're out of time already?
I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah.
But at least one more question.
Yeah, sure. Anybody have any other comments or questions? Those two really good ones.
In our culture, we don't have so many things that are like, you know, hunting and fishing and things like that. And I couldn't help but, you know, be thinking, part of our culture is like the idea that truth is relative. And how is what you're saying, being open and seeing the different forms of light, how does that translate into us sharing, you know, the gospel and our faith with people and saying, well, that's your perspective, but mine's just as good?
Well, they might say, if they're satisfied with theirs, they're never going to come into our beam of light anyway. But we are interested in those people who realize that their beam of light is partial or inadequate. And therefore, we can say, well, your ball game isn't meeting your criterion. You feel there's something inadequate about your ball game or your perspective. We invite you freely to come and experiment, peek into ours and see what you think. I think that's legitimate. And I don't think that's relativistic, because I don't want to sound triumphalistic here that we're the best and the greatest, because as Christians, we're not much better than anybody else who claims to be Christian, as far as our sinfulness is concerned. But we're sitting on the roof of the shed, and we see the whole sky. So we're not inviting people, so to speak, to come over to our little beam of light and peek in. We're inviting them to climb up on the roof and see the whole thing. Because that's what we would claim the Orthodox Church is. It's not one more perspective on Christianity or one more point of view on the gospel. It's the fullness. And so if you want that, it's available. It's possible. And that's what we're inviting you to come, as the first Sunday of Great Lent says, come and see. They have no idea what we've got. And we almost don't know how to articulate it, do we? It's one thing, I'm glad you mentioned this. It's not relative, in my opinion. I believe that we have something, you know, the whole sky, the whole picture. I think we have something that no other faith tradition in the world can offer, and that's Paschal joy. Most of you, I think, you know what I'm talking about when I say there are moments, for all of us, I hope, For me, I'm certain. There are moments during the services, especially Holy Week and Pascha, when completely uninduced and unprovoked, you are suddenly overcome with such joy that you can't go on. That if you're in the choir, you can't sing the next note. And if you tried, you'd burst into tears. Do you know what I'm talking about? That's what, you can't get that saying your prayers at home. It's not going to happen there. You can't do that climbing a mountain. People say, oh, but I'm spiritual. I go for mountain hikes. I'm a member of the Sierra Club. Good, I'm glad you are. And you probably have a little foretaste of what I'm talking about. But what I've got is the overwhelming sense of all of that. And I don't think you can have that anyplace else except in an Orthodox church during Holy Week and Pascha. I want you to have that joy. I want you to experience that certitude of Christ's resurrection. And the only way you can have it is to make the effort to come here, stand, pay attention, listen, and let the Holy Spirit zap you when he will, because we have no control over it. But when I talk to Orthodox audiences about precisely this, most of them know exactly what I'm talking about. And they say, yeah, that's it, but we never talk about it because we think we're losing our minds. We think we're going crazy. And yet, I can see in some of your eyes, you know exactly what I'm talking about. That's what, that was, the church is like a magnifying glass and we're like kindling. The sun is everywhere. But in the church, like God, God's presence is everywhere. But the church is like the magnifying glass where the sun, where God's grace and presence and love is focused in such a way that if we're in the proper alignment, sun, magnifying glass and kindling. If we're in that proper alignment, putting ourselves consciously and deliberately under the church, in the church, listening to the prayers and hymns and rituals of the church, we're capable of fire. That's why we come to the church. There's no substitute for putting yourself under that magnifying glass. You'll not be fire in your closet, no matter how sincerely you pray, and no matter how beautiful the nature of the world inspires you to give thanks to God for his beauty and glory, you still will not have the joy that we experience at Pascha year after year, unless you're under the magnifying glass, which is the church. And we just need to invite people to that. And that's not relative. That's an absolute truth. But if you tell people that, I don't think that would be helpful. Then they'll back away. Oh, you're another one who claims to have the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And people are, in our society, as you say, relativistic, and they'll be allergic to that. So that's what you can't say, even though it's true. But you can invite people to come and see and hope that the Spirit of God will, in fact, give them that gift of paschal joy that the rest of us are talking about and the rest of us are looking forward to. That's our culture. In exactly the beam of light, looking at the world definition. That's who we are. And a Greek can understand that, and a Serb, and a Ukrainian, and a Russian, and an Albanian. We all know this. It's just we never talk about it somehow. When was the last time you were overwhelmed with the peace of God that passes all understanding? The peace that the priest is constantly hoping we get. Peace be with you all. But that's the peace he's talking about. The peace that if you get it, you can't go any further. It's why the Holy Fathers say, silence is the language of heaven. Because we'll be so overwhelmed with joy, we won't be able to talk. I wish you all paschal joy.
Thank you, Father.
Thank you, Father Michael.
It's a joy to be here. Thank you.
Let me take this off of you.
Oh, yeah. Before I walk out.